Welcome to Optimistic Voices, a podcast of helping children worldwide. We help children worldwide by strengthening and empowering families and communities. This podcast is for people interested in deep conversations with thought leaders in the field of child welfare, global health, and international missions.
Welcome to Optimistic Voices podcast. I am Emmanuel Nabil, NABS for short. We are doing something a little different with this episode. We have asked Reverend Tom Barlin, who is a lead pastor at Flores United Methodist Church in Herndon, Virginia, to guest host this episode for us. Flores United Methodist Church, which is a multi-site congregation with vital mission partnerships in Northern Virginia and around the globe. Tom and his church were part of the founding members of the orphanage, the Child Rescue Center by then, the orphanage that I grew up in. And also later in the years, Tom led his congregation through the transition of that orphanage to family care. So Tom, you are welcome.
Hey, thanks, Emmanuel. And I'm so glad to be here. Friends, for years, we've been hearing about what is typically called the global orphan crisis. And we know that there is in the neighborhood of somewhere around 140 million children in the world who are classified as orphans. And that's a child whose parent has died. Now, of those, more than 5 million live in an orphanage. So think of a building that holds those children, different buildings all over the globe. COVID has added an additional 10 million children to that overall number. And the number of children who have lost one or more caregivers during the pandemic continues to grow and will do so with new variations of that virus. Now, there have always been orphans. For centuries, Christians have stepped up and we've answered the call to care for these children. And we do so in part because of the biblical mandate to care for orphans and widows. We also do so because it is a good and right and decent thing to do. Most often, when Christians do this work, it takes the form of building orphanages to house them. That is, buildings are built, children are brought in, staffs are employed. Now, I want to share with you a challenging idea from our friend Ellie Oswald of Faith in Action, which reframes how we think about a response to orphans. Ellie said, and I'm quoting, "If the problem is that a child isn't orphaned, the solution isn't an orphanage. It's a family." Now, this September, a group within the United Methodist Church launched a campaign to promote ministry with orphan children and vulnerable youth among Methodists. What's unique about this campaign isn't unique for Methodists. We like to know what God is calling us to, and then we like to understand how to do it the right way, and hopefully, we go and do just that. This campaign does some different things. First, it promotes family care models as the right response for orphan children. Now, let me say that again. Family care models. That includes safe, permanent families of all shapes and sizes. Second thing it does is it provides guidance for people who want to engage in ministry with orphan children and vulnerable youth. We want to ensure a strong family for every child. That's actually the slogan that this group's using, a strong family for every child. To help kick this off, we've invited some experts today who are part of the planning committee working on this campaign. I want to introduce you to Reverend Wayne Lavender, who's the United Methodist pastor, currently serving as the executive director of the Foundation for Orphans and is a faculty member in the political science department at Quinnipiac. Oh, Wayne, did I get that right? Quinnipiac University? Quinnipiac. I'm so sorry. I actually tried that ahead of time. Quinnipiac University. It addresses the global orphan crisis, and that's been his mission for more than 20 years. Now, Emmanuel Nabs Nabiyu, who you just heard from, is the director of mission advancement and partnership at Helping Children Worldwide. Nabs grew up in an orphanage in Sierra Leone, one that I was a part of, the church I serve was a part of, called the Child Rescue Center. After going to university and receiving a degree in organizational leadership, he returned to the orphanage to accept the position as the director, and that was a big moment for all of us. In that leadership role, he transitioned the model of care to programs that work with families. So he moved it from a building-based model to a family-based model. Rather than housing orphan children, they quickly began to place children in family care, and they strengthened those families so that that'd be a success. His story and the reasons for that change are going to be of deep interest to you as you listen in. And finally, Cherie Reese is here. She is the Global Impact Program Director at Church of the Resurrection in Kansas City, Missouri. While Cherie began her career in the corporate world, she has since transitioned in her position at Church of the Resurrection. And that allows her to mix her passion for marginalized persons with her passion for Christ. And she also brings just a lot of business skills and analytical thinking to that role. In the beginning of 2022, she and several others started a podcast called Bridging Cultures, to give voice to those around the world an opportunity to share their stories of community development and personal transformation. Church of the Resurrection specifically prioritizes missions that are focused on family care models for orphans. So they've been doing this thinking as well. While Gaston Warner and Regan Kabira of Zoe Empowers are unable to join us for this podcast, they've graciously provided a pre-recorded segment regarding their organization's response to orphanhood. Now, we all know, or we think we know, that children living in orphanages are actually orphans. In fact, I think if I went out on the street and said to anyone I met, "Hey, what's an orphan?" I'm betting they'd say, "Well, an orphan is a child with no parents." And that means that a child in an orphanage is obviously an orphan. And what I want to know is, am I right?
That is not right. Definitely, most children in orphanages have parents. You see, many years ago, UNICEF defined an orphan as a child who has lost one or both parents. Most Western supporters of orphanages don't know that 80 to 90% of children classified as orphans in orphanages have at least one parent who is still living. And sometimes in crisis, governments and communities fall apart and children are separated from their families. And then they have no way to find each other and have no idea what has happened to them. And of course, the governments don't normally have anything in place to manage situations like that. So the child will be living on the street, separated, or living in the orphanage, separated from their parents, unaware that their parents are living and their parents are in crisis. They are unable to find or care for the child. That is a small percentage of the orphan crisis. But those children will normally end up on the streets or in an orphanage.
So when I met Emmanuel at the age of 9 or 10, I was told that he had no family, that he was an orphan because he had no family at all. And can I tell you something, friends? It is nothing but good news when you know a child who's living in an orphanage and someone tells you, by the way, he has a family.
Yeah.
And the thing that you want more than anything is for that child to find that family. And so this is just true globally. One big orphan myth is that all of the kids in orphanages are actually orphans. Aside from the parents and the children who don't know that the other person is alive, which is a small percentage, but research tells us that 80% of kids who live in orphanages have a living parent who could care for them if they had help. Mm-hmm. Now, Wayne, the obvious question is, why are these children living in orphanages?
Well, we believe that there's as many as 5 million children living in orphanages right now. So if that's the case, there's probably 5 million reasons. But the overriding answer, the overriding reason is poverty, and it's extreme poverty. And so we have poverty in our country. We have deep and sustainable poverty that we're trying to break. But when you go to the developing nations of the world, you see a form of poverty that Americans can't appreciate or understand. And so you have moms and dads in dire situations where maybe there was a drought or flooding or something happened, a tree fell across their house and they lost income. And so they're doing what they think is best for their children by putting them into an orphanage. They're trying to help them. So that's why they're going in, because the parents can't support them. There's no family. There's no resources. It's basically a poverty issue.
Now, Wayne, you've been doing this for over 20 years, and we often use the term global orphan crisis, but you've got a different term. You call it an orphan pandemic. What do you mean by that distinction?
Yeah, well, I also use the word orphan crisis. I use that for most of these past 20 years. I began calling it the orphan pandemic when the COVID-19 pandemic struck. We all know that approximately or over a million Americans have died from this pandemic. We're all affected by it. We're all impacted by it. We, you know, had to stop and close down our churches and go to virtual. We had to do that with meetings, with universities, with schools. It affected every single one of our lives, and still a million people died. So we think of the orphan crisis is like a pandemic. 6 million children die every year around the world. That's a pandemic. That should be an unacceptable number to everyone listening and watching this podcast. So I use the word pandemic to sort of give it a little bit more focus and a little bit more of a punch. It is, in reality, though, a family separation crisis. It's not just orphans, since 80 to 90% of them have family that they could be reunited with and integrated with. So I think if we start seeing it as a family separation crisis caused by poverty, we can address it in new and more effective ways.
So Sheree, talk about that term, family separation crisis. Part of what we're doing today is helping people pick up a vocabulary and a working knowledge of this. What's a family separation crisis?
I think the key that Wayne just hit on is it's not just these aren't children that are just solo or by themselves, that they've lost all of their family. They've lost their parents, siblings, things like that. They're not by themselves. Most children in an orphanage actually do have those family members that Wayne's talking about. So when you have that one child that is put into an institution, that affects everyone. And sometimes that happens because of a natural disaster or war or some sort of big picture thing, and that children need a place to go or a place to live. But that also includes, and actually a majority of the time, includes the economic piece. So families aren't putting their children there temporarily because of a disaster or war or because there's no more family, but because of poverty. They can't afford to feed their child. They can't afford to clothe their child. And they have this perception that their child, and sometimes verifiably so, that their child will be better off in an institution. And that may be what that may be so material-wise, but emotionally and mentally is a different story. And when that child is separated or put into that institution for their good, that affects the entire family. That affects everyone else, whether they're put into an institution as well, or whether they're the parent that actually can't care for that child. That's a huge hardship.
So Sheree, that sounds like an important framing for you, that the problem is not about orphanhood. Mm-hmm. The problem is about family separation. I'm wondering, as you share that with people, has it helped? Does it help people see what's really going on in the world?
If you go in think it's an orphan crisis, you're automatically assuming it's just this one child and this child needs a place to go. When you realize it's a family separation crisis, then you realize that there are other people that can surround that child with care or with love. And that trauma not only affects that child, but the entire family. So if you realize that it affects everyone equally or unequally, either way, everyone's affected, then when you bring them together and you focus on that unit of a family, and we'll talk more about what an actual family is, because I know a lot of times when we say family, we automatically think a mom, dad, and kids, or a mom and kids, or whatever that might be. And when we talk about families, we talk about something much bigger. But what we do know is we need to keep family units together for the good of the child and the good of everyone.
Some of us know the pressure that comes when there is an institutional orphanage. Part of what you have to figure out is the funding for that, because real live children live in that space and they eat every day and they go to school. And, you know, so what people might say is, mm-hmm. they're thinking about, you know, how to make all that work is, look, an orphanage is a better place for a child than being on the street. It's a lot better than being on the street. Or we might say, you know, an orphanage that provides access to education, 3 square meals a day and mm-hmm. other things, that's better than starving. Yeah. And Nebs, as somebody who has actually said some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say there was a time when we were trying to figure all that out, and I understand those arguments. But what do you say to that? How do you speak back into that question?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I'll start, there's no doubt about it. Yes, orphanages, when children grow up in orphanage, when they are in orphanage, the orphanage provides a lot of tangible benefits, like food and clothes and healthcare and all those things. And I really, really enjoyed those things. To be very honest, there are those time moments where I really needed those facilities because when I live on the street and later trace my uncle, I was really struggling. He could not provide all those things. So that was leading me to leave the house, and I became a street-connected child, going back and forth from the house and back to the street because I wanted to go there and find food. So when the orphanage thing came up, my uncle saw it's an opportunity. And that's how many families are seen, are vulnerable families. And I saw it's an opportunity. I wanted to go to school. That was my dream. So I went to the orphanage together with many, many other children. And then I was happy that I was having food, continuously. Now, I never had to struggle for food and education, everything, clothes and everything. But those were very tangible. But as I was getting those needs met, I reached to a point where I really started. I was not starving for food, for any of them, but I was starving for family. I was starving for connection. I needed to belong. So that's what orphanages can provide, the tangible benefits, but they cannot provide the intangible benefit that needs that children really need to thrive. That is the connection, the identity, the love that children need to form with their forever families and their communities. So, and we can say that family is not only because it's the foundational relationship that children build. But it's very good for children because it provides them with access to their culture, their language, their traditions, all of that. And it's very, very important. So the question normally we used to ask is, why can't we find a way to do both? Do children have to really, families have to choose between sending their children to orphanages in order to access the tools they need to be a better future and at the expense of the love and connection they and their children need to thrive? Can't we find a way to do both? I believe we can do that. And that's how many organizations around the world are doing now, that when children grow up in orphanages, it doesn't only affect the children, but affect their families and affect our communities as well as the society as a whole. So it's true that orphanages can provide those tangible benefits. But of course, the point is those tangible benefits can never, no matter how good they are, replace the love, the connection, the identity that children need to thrive.
Yeah. So it just so happens that all of us on this panel are United Methodists. And obviously, this is not a uniquely United Methodist issue. But I am curious, and Wayne, let me ask you this question. As Christians, why do we believe that family-based care is better than building institution-based care of an orphan?
Well, the Bible tells us 30 times to care for orphans. John Wesley said caring for orphans was the highest form of charity on the earth. And this is, like you said, not just for Methodists, but you know, Catholics should be doing this, Baptists should be doing this, Congregationalists, all denominations. It's interesting to note that the Quran itself tells its followers to care for orphans 22 times. So this is something that can unite all the Abrahamic faiths and traditions. But as Methodists, we know that our denomination was started on a college campus. John Wesley and his brother Charles were students at Christ Church in Oxford, and then John became a professor. John used the latest technologies. He believed in reason. It was one of the cornerstones. If there's a better way, and there is a better way, we should be doing it. We don't have the ability or the scope or the scale in orphanages that we have in reintroducing children to their old family, sometimes with a stipend in the Zoe model. This is a better way, and it will help the United Methodist Church. I mean, we have a two punch that have knocked us to the ground in the last couple of years, the ongoing schism, which has been delayed, and the COVID, which, you know, sent us back to our homes. My conference, we closed 20 churches at this annual conference. We have 20 more about to close probably before the end of this year. Our churches are just looking for something to do to reopen. You know, they want to go back to what we were doing before. We have something that can unite our denomination, give us something to focus on, something biblical and Wesleyan and something that works. this is really good news. And so I hope and pray that the listeners and watchers can be excited by this and see that with new research and best practices, we can be effective and mitigate and eventually end both, you know, orphan crisis and or family separation crisis by getting kids back in their families where they belong and where they do best. And it costs less money than putting them in orphanage. It's a win-win-win.
So if we agree that children do better in families, what does that word family mean? What constitutes a family? They come in all shapes and sizes. So when you say family, what do you mean?
Yeah, you're right. It just comes in all shapes and forms. And just with my exposure to the Western culture, it means a little bit different from the African culture and other Asian culture and kind of. So I know African-American culture tend to be a little bit more nuclear system of family, mom, dad, and just very immediate. There are many families in most of these countries where the orphanages are widely spread. They deem more of the extended family system. Like our partners in Sierra Leone, the Child Reintegration Center, the CLC, they use a continuum of care, which is actually now used by many organizations around the world. What that means is that when they bring children in, children either from the street or try to teach them from the orphanage, they have this whole thing about doing a family tree in order to trace every family member that is connected to that child. So always you go starting with the biological family, you know, the mom or the dad. If they are not suitable already, suitability has to be in as much as we are trying to advocate for children to go back into families, we want to make sure we do it responsibly. That means we don't place children back into abusive situation or harmful situation, because if we do that, we might be causing more harm than good. We have to know the first thing that led children to orphanages in the first place. So that means we have to make sure we assess each family unit and the community where the children are going to stay. So normally start up with the biological immediate family members, the mom or dad, biological. And then if not, they go down the continuum of care, which is they go to the kinship care, which the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents, and those are always, always ready to take in children. And research even shows that 90% of children that are orphans and vulnerable children around the world, they end up staying with extended families, uncles and grandmothers and aunties. And those people are the ones who are taking care. That's how the culture is. Those cultures are built as socially and relationship-driven culture. So that means if those people do not work, aunties and uncles, the kinship doesn't work, they will go down to what we call the fostering system, you know, the foster parent, a responsible adult in the community, a Christian, a Muslim, responsible adult in the community where they can take care of a child. And then if that doesn't work, we can think about adoption. CLC and many organizations think about domestic adoption in the first place, because it's also very harsh to just take a child out of their culture and send them abroad, processing international adoption. Especially when it is not done right, it creates further trauma. Not only in the child and the family, because separation of any form brings trauma. Separation is trauma. So they go along this continuum of care to make sure this all constitutes of a family unit. Not only the biological family, but they talk about all these other units that are taking care of the child. And of course, obviously, it's not just about taking the child, identifying their family, and dropping them and leave. No, you have to think about what will make them stay home. That's what we talk about reunification, making the family whole. Reintegration is just placing the child back into family. And the reunification is what preparations that need to be done in order to make sure that family stays together so that they don't separate again. They stay together. They are not being abusive situation. Rather, the mother needs to be enrolled into a family strengthening program so that their capacity can be built in order to be able to take care of their own children so that they can stay together. So like strengthening the family so that they can be able to stay together and be able to have that dignity to responsible for themselves and the well-being of their kids. So that's basically what a family is, holistic.
It's all of what Nabs said, but I want to expand it even just a little bit further. So one of the things that Zoe does, who we'll hear about in a little bit, is they bring kids together. And when I say kids, that could be anywhere from, you know, 4 or 5 young kids all the way up to early 20s. They bring these people, young people together. And then the oldest in that family group, so if there's 3 siblings, the oldest becomes the head of household. So they may be a sibling, but now they are kind of like the one that is overseeing their family unit. Sometimes that family could be 3 separate children. Let's say the 3 of us are young people somewhere in the world, and we don't have a family. And so yet the 3 of us can come together and we're going to be each other's family. So maybe So maybe Wayne, you're the head of household for our family, and therefore you are the one who may learn a vocation and help oversee to make sure we have a house and make sure we're all cared for. Maybe you can send me to school as a younger sibling. We might not be related in any way, except that we'll come together and be each other's family. We'll celebrate holidays together. We'll celebrate birthdays together. We'll go through hardships together, and we'll become a forever family.
I think we see that even in the movie Slumdog Millionaire. I'm sure a lot of the viewers and listeners have seen that. So those three young children became a family. Now, the two boys were blood brothers, but they brought in the young woman as well, Letitia. They were vulnerable kids. Their family had died, but they formed their own little nuclear family. Now, it turns out they were vulnerable too, ended up with that drug lord. So this is what happens if we don't help them out. We can imagine in the bush in Africa or other places around the world, there might be a grandmother. She's disabled. She's older. She can barely move. And there might be 8 or 10 kids, some of whom related to her, some not. They become a family unit. So we want to build on those family units and give them the skills in which they can move forward.
Exactly. So the neat thing about Zoe is when they bring the children together, they focus on the child holistically. So it's not just where they live, or it's not just nutrition. It's not just health and hygiene, but it also includes spiritual guidance, includes child rights. So they bring all these pieces together to help those heads of households and the children navigate their way forward. They bring local leaders from the community that will be mentors to the children. So they kind of get that community buy-in that brings them together. And because they have the local leaders that are mentors to the children, they teach the older children how to become their own small groups. So they will vote one of the children to be the president, one of the children to be the treasurer, one of the children to be the secretary, so that they are not only owning their next steps as a group and not only working their way forwards, but they also, you don't need a ton of outside staff coming in to oversee it, because there's so much community buy-in and local leadership that they really help lead each other and lead themselves out of poverty. And that's what makes it economically efficient, which is incredible, because instead of spending thousands upon thousands of dollars on one child over 18 years and then they leave, you're spending maybe $1,000 on a child and then they graduate and move on and you can move on to the next child. So family is pretty much the foundation of what Zoe is. It's bringing these children together that don't have a family, or if they do, bringing that family together so that children have the emotional support, the love, they know that they're cared for. Everything is focused around caring for each other. And that's why, you know, Wayne even talked about Slumdog Millionaire, how they brought in, I think you said her name's Letitia. These Zoe kids do this. I mean, they have their own family, and they see another child that actually doesn't have parents or siblings, and they see them solo, and they want that same love for these other children. And so they do adopt them into the family, which is just amazing, because, you know, when you think about it and you look back on through the years in your life, you know, for most of us that had healthy family relationships, those are the highlights in our life. I mean, that's the most important thing, is some of those connections. And when we didn't have those solid family relationships, we grew up with a lot of hurt and trauma because we had a rough childhood or a rough family. And I think that just points to the fact that we should be looking for family-based care for every child around the world, not just for us.
Sri, that's a great segue. Let's hear from Gaston and Regan of Zoe Empowers Project about how Zoe helps children like these find a sense of belonging and a sense of family. That we've got a pre-recorded message we're going to share.
Hello, my name is Gaston Warner. I'm CEO of Zoe Empowers Global North, and I'm here with my colleague, Regan Kabiria, who is CEO of Zoe Empowers Global South. And it's such a pleasure for us to join this conversation. There's a spectrum of care working with orphaned young people, and there's quite a lot of attention on moving from orphanage and institutional care to family care and family strengthening, and absolutely rightly so. There's estimates that there's 150 million orphan children in the world, and 5 to 8 million of those are in orphanage care. And there's a lot of attention in the field, and rightly so, to moving those young people into family care, which is going to provide better results. Zoe Empowers occupies kind of an interesting space on the spectrum of care. Our focus has never really been on orphanage care. Our focus has been on finding the tens of thousands of child and youth-headed families that are already struggling for survival in places of extreme poverty. And so our effort has always been to kind of strengthen those families. And Zoe started in an interesting way. I'll give a little introduction and then turn it over to my colleague, Reagan, to give more context. But Zoe started in kind of 2007, when Zoe Empowers, that it existed as a relief organization prior to having a transformation, met a Rwandan social worker named Epiphany Mujuwamana. And Epiphany had been raised as a vulnerable child in Rwanda at the age of 8. Her father had passed away. Her mother was disabled. She worked to put food on the table for her family and to put herself through school and became a successful adult. And then the 1994 genocide wiped out her country. And her heart went out to these thousands of orphaned young people and child-headed households and youth-headed households trying to survive. And so Epiphany went to work for some large Western aid organizations and became disillusioned with the work, which she saw as an endless cycle of relief and then dependency on that relief with no exit ramp where these young people could stand on their own. So Epiphany and a team of other Rwandan social workers, disillusioned by that endless cycle, started going directly to the villages and talking to the local leadership, and more importantly, directly to the young people themselves, asking the question, not what can we do to help these young people, but what would these young people need in their lives in order to help themselves, in order to stand on their own feet and to never need charity again. And so with that very different question in mind, they came up with a very different approach. And the approach is led by the youth and the heads of these families that are already in existence. And it utilizes it with an all indigenous staff in every country of service. They had the local community stand behind these young people, and these young people gather together in what we call empowerment groups, kind of family groups of 20 to 30 families in each group. The heads of the households took a primary leadership role, but all the siblings also participated. And it's a 3-year empowerment program that looks at every area of need, from, you know, staying safe and healthy with food and housing and child rights so that there's safety for these young people and health and hygiene, to moving on to skilled for long-term success with education and vocational training, with business development so that they're able to provide for themselves and their families, and with things like financial fluency so that they're on this upward trajectory through the program. And then finally, the ability to lead truly meaningful lives by their own definition, which involves things like community reintegration, where they're seen as respected members of their larger community, not just being able to provide for their family. Family reintegration, where maybe adults can be found in their lives that once they have some income, there's some possibilities there, but they reintegrate with agency. So they're not at the mercy of adults, but they still long to have adults in their lives, but in ways that they still have their own rights enforced and their own income. And then things like spiritual strength. Zoe's a Christian program that's religiously non-restrictive. Everyone's welcome to participate, but we do share the gospel in words and action during the 3 years. And finally, this is my favorite part, the ability to give back. Once their own lives start to stabilize, We see these young people start to adopt other orphans, to train other orphans, to reach out to other vulnerable people in their community and raise the whole community with the work they do. So Zoe started funding Epiphany's work, and everything she was doing was so much better than anything we were doing that we pulled the whole organization behind this distinctive, if not unique, approach. And then God started to bless it. It moved to Kenya, and Reagan Kabiria, my colleague, was hired over a dozen years ago. And now it's in 7 countries, 6 in Africa and also India. And we have graduated close to 160,000 orphan children and vulnerable youth have either graduated or are currently enrolled in the program. And the replicability and sustainability is off the charts. So with that kind of brief introduction, and I'd love to dig down on any of those points, but I want to turn it over to my colleague, Reagan Kabiria, who actually runs the program and kind of brings in other organizations to share this program with. So Reagan, thanks for joining today. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, after having worked for Zoe and worked for other organizations before Zoe, what makes Zoe's approach different?
Thank you so much, Gaston, for this great introduction and the work that you support to ensure that young people are empowered and move away from the level where they need charity to a level where they become self-sufficient. Zoe provides a concrete alternative approach from the institutional-based to family and community-based care, where the community and the family take the lead in ensuring that every child in the community is respected and able to find their space in the community. And one way of doing it is that in our community, in Africa in general, there are so many, many young people that need this kind of support, that are vulnerable or orphaned, and they need support. Mostly when we go to the institution, it becomes a little difficult because there are so many that are left behind. From the statistics, and nearly more than half of children that are in institutions more than half are left out there. And these young people need care and they need support. And the only way to do about it is to have institutions working from the family. And one of the biggest things that I've learned in my experience is when the family takes the lead, it becomes very easy, including the head of the household. African tradition demands that head of the family takes the lead. And these young people that have left behind, they take care of their brothers and sisters. And when I talk of many young people that are left there, like today, I went to the community. And it was very surprising for me to see how many young people that turned up to be enrolled or recruited, join Zoe program. Unfortunately, we were not able to do much. There are so many that are out there. It's only like a half of who came up that we were able to pick. The rest are left out in the community.
How many showed up today in the village?
Today, like we wanted to have like 500 young people, families, and we had over 1,500 that turned up. So from that, we only picked a third of the whole population that we were able to pick to join the program. The rest are left out there. And I believe when we have a program like Zoe, where children learn the skill, one thing that can happen, they can be part of empowering other young people that are in the community. They will learn the skill and they will help us also support other children that are left there. They will stay with the other orphaned young people in the families. They come to visit them in their home. They connect, they meet in the church. So the information that we share with them when they are out in the community, They are able to share the same information. They are able to train others. So when you take the community-based approach or family approach, you ensure that every family is able to benefit from the one that has gone through the Zoe program. So that's one of the biggest things. There are so many young people that are out there that need care. Our facilities cannot afford. Zoe is unique also because of the cost effectiveness. I mean, the much that we invest in every household. So in a family, you train one child and this child trains the other. So there's what the peer-to-peer training, child-to-child training, and there's peer-to-peer learning where they learn from each other. And this, it is replicated in the whole community. So Zoe lives to be a model of its own. And the other part is that you develop what I've learned also, these young people, when they lead the process, when they are there to help their brothers and sisters, they take their self-esteem. They feel like we are part of the family. We are the ones that brought our brother's community member up. So they feel proud of that, which is a very positive thing in the community. It's a different way of looking at things. It's a kind of a paradigm shift where how do we ensure that the family takes the lead of empowering their own brothers and sisters. And our role as a program is to support them with the necessary materials, whatever they support they need, and then they replicate that through their effort, through their energy. And it has made it the best program you can think of.
Reagan, thank you so much for sharing that. And we'd love to be further conversation partners with any other organization. Zoe wants to grow its own program, but also share it with other organizations. As Reagan said, it's a paradigm shift that we feel has a lot of power. There's a book, From Relief to Empowerment, that kind of goes into all this in a little bit more detail that we're happy to share with anyone. And thank you for allowing us to be part of this critical discussion and kind of represent this part of the spectrum of care. God bless everyone. Thank you.
So I'm hearing empowering, I'm hearing equipping, mm-hmm. building capacity. Like these are all good words. So that space of security exists, a group of people to come home to exists, and in a sense of relationship and connectivity that's not temporary. It's not based on who shows up at work today. It's based on long-term relationships that we've established. And it sounds like there's sort of a formal and an informal covenant there that keeps people together. NABS, HCW, Helping Children Worldwide, and their partner program in Africa, the Child Reintegration Center, has family strengthening workshops that they offer to families. From a financial perspective, in your opinion, why is that an important element of the program?
We all know it is very expensive to support people indefinitely. And it's not good for people, of course, over dependency. Nobody wants to continue to be reliant on support. We don't want to create dependence for the family so that they cannot live without our support. Because that's the first place. If we know the reason why many children are going to orphanages is because of poverty, have those tangible needs to provide for their kids. So that means if you send them back home, if we start to strengthen them, as Sherry was talking about empowerment and equipping them and strengthening those families, way that can make them to stay together, it's very, very important, because strengthening families and releasing them from support when they are ready, it does more than just, you know, building that capacity to just strengthen that family over time, but actually also helps communities to get stronger. It helps our society to get stronger. And once society starts getting stronger, they start thriving. And we all start winning, as Winnie was saying. So it's very financial, from the financial piece of it, it's very, very important. And of course, it shows that it's very expensive to take care of children living in institutions than compared to when taking care of children when they are in family care. You know, research has shown that it's like 8 to 10 times more expensive to run an orphanage when you spend on one child. We saw that at our organization, Helping Children Worldwide. We are spending a lot of money, like over about $3,000 just on one child. That's not even including other expenses. And they want to move them to family care to start empowering the family and just look at what they need what can just make that situation right to move them from where they are so that they're no longer stuck on support and become independent. What they need from that is less, like it's about $75 to $300, a higher range, to be able to empower, help a family out of that poverty so that they are able to take care of themselves and their own kids. So financially, it makes a lot of sense to be able to make sure that you help those families to stay together so that they don't go back to the streets.
It must be difficult to take a child who's been living in an orphanage mm-hmm. or a child who's been living on the street and help them move back into a family setting. Like that's a real transition. How do you help those families prepare for that?
Yeah, the same thing. So it's also the length of time a child has spent on the street or in the orphanage counts a lot when they are doing reintegration, sending them back home. The longer a child has stayed on the streets or in the orphanage, the harder sometimes it becomes to be able to make sure they get reintegrated safely back into family and then to actually stay in that family for a long time. Like when I was living on the street, again, just an example, when I later went to my uncle, it was very hard for me to stay at home because of all there was still no food, lack of food, and there was still a lot of issues I was going through. And we used to just, you know, living on the street and maybe doing some hard jobs, and I was still at least short of getting a meal on the street after hard work. So it was very, very hard. So, but like the same thing, when children leave institutions, although they have been used to eating 3 meals a day and all those things, for them to just adjust easily in the home setting so that they don't go back to orphanages, we've seen that happening over time. Some institutions will take some children home, and then some children will run back to the institution because they are hungry. They want to be able to eat. So that is the reason why it is so important to make sure that you don't just drop children home, but you really have to do something to help them be able to equip them and empower them and build that capacity so that they can be able to take care of their own children.
So it could sound, if you're listening to all this, that we're advocating for no more orphanages anywhere, anytime. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, is that the case? Is that what we're trying to communicate? And Sheree, what do you think?
So in theory, yes. But unfortunately, the real world awaits. There will always be some sort of war or some sort of, I mean, you just look at Ukraine and all the children being separated from families. You can't just magically get these children reunited with their families. You don't know if their parents are still alive, Lord willing they are, or some other disaster, whether it be a disease or something else. I mean, there's often times where we need some sort of location to transition children. And then there's other times that there are children with special needs that families just can't care. An untraditional or a traditional family is unable to care for that child. With that said, you know, if there's a better way than an institution for a child, shame on us for not finding it. If an institution is the only answer for a child, then we still need to find ways to have a family connection with that child forever, not just for the time that they're there, but forever. We all need forever families. So yes, we'd love that for us to be institution free, but there are exceptions, just like there is, unfortunately, for pretty much everything out there. There's just exceptions.
So Wayne, your organization is sort of in this transition that Sheree just pointed to, and you have supported orphanages, in fact, still do, but you're making that transition now. Talk about why you, and perhaps if you're working with the board, why are you shifting that model, and what is your hope for the future?
Yeah, so we built our first orphanage after visits to Mozambique in 1998 and 2002. At the time, orphanages were the standard operating procedure. The church in Mozambique asked us to build orphanages. We were replacing terrible orphanages that had no running water, no electricity, were in the bush. Kids were getting malaria. So we built our first orphanage. You know, my church rallied behind it. We raised funds in 2003 and 2004. It was built in 2005. We built a second orphanage because it was the same model, a third and a fourth and a fifth. I knew, though, somehow intellectually and intuitively that this was not the right answer, particularly after research began coming out saying that, you know, there was emotional harm to these children. Cognitive scientists and child therapists were saying this was not good. The United Nations was showing this was not the right answer. But the people in Mozambique kept asking us to come back and build orphanages. We knew how to build orphanages. we thought our orphanage were better than what the United Nations was talking about, you know, because we were trying to provide families. We were doing educational, emotional, physical, and spiritual support. But the reality is we didn't know a better way. And so I've told my students all for years that when the student is ready, the teacher will emerge. And at a workshop, people from Helping Children Worldwide, Melody and Laura, showed up and showed us a better way. I met Gaston 10 years ago and again 6 years ago, and Gaston told me about his model, but I just wasn't ready for it. I was busy, right? We can all say that. I was running a church. I was teaching a university, running the Foundation for Orphans. Now I'm ready for it. Now I've read the data more. Our board is now ready. We have a direction in which to go through. All this makes sense for us now that didn't make sense for us 10 years ago. I wish we had changed 5 years ago. Can't go back and change time. But what I can do is embrace a new model now and into the future and help other people embrace this model as well.
So we may have people who are watching right now who sponsor children in an orphanage, or maybe they belong to a church that sponsors an orphanage or supports an orphanage somewhere. So the question is, all that comes out of great motivation, scripturally informed motivation. What would be the next steps for a person who's in that situation and says, you know what, I'd like to do a new thing?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you. Most of this, you know, all of you are doing this because we care for children. We want to follow what the Bible says. It's beautiful. Those are coming from good places, you know, from good hearts. So you are caring for the world's most vulnerable children. We agree there, and that's very beautiful. And thank you. God bless your hearts. So the other thing is, don't stop there. You see, if you want to help, you can do more. So find out more about family care programs. Start a conversation in your church about what you are learning here today. Start a conversation with the orphanage leaders you work with about the possibility of changing the model to a program that provides support to families so kids can go home or be supported in families. Don't just pull your funding or send all the kids home. It is possible to transition an orphanage, but it is a process. There are experts who can help. Helping Children Worldwide is one of them. Your church might be interested in getting engaged for the first time. So why not check out programs like Zoe Project and see if that's the right fit for you? Or find programs like Helping Children Worldwide, the Child Reintegration Center programs, already doing family reintegration and family strengthening. So this is a learning moment. As we said, there's no blame, there's no shame. I like to tell you, we are here to learn and we are here to share. We know better, we do better. It's never too late. Thank you.
Sri, Church of the Resurrection brings a lot of expertise to this because you've been very intentional about the kinds of missions that the church supports, and particularly when it comes to missions for orphans and vulnerable children. Share a little bit about what you've learned and what Resurrection has learned and knows, and how that affects your approach to this type of mission. I'm hoping there are people that can learn from your expertise.
Yeah, it's similar to what Wayne says about education and learning new ways. And that's one thing that we've learned over the years. You know, the best practice of anything that we do internationally is through the local leaders, is through the local people, local solutions for local problems. And a lot of that has to do with raising up local leaders, empowering the next generation of leaders, giving people dignity, or by listening to them, by encouraging them, by telling them that they are amazing and they have incredible ideas, just supporting what they're thinking, and that everything is sustainable, locally led, and to build their capacity. And so all of that goes to, what do these children need to be able to have all those things? And they need a solid foundation, and that solid foundation is based upon love, respect, just unconditional support. And, you know, as Wayne talked about how different studies have shown that without that as a child, you grow up at a deficit. You grow up thinking that you're not worthy or you're unlovable. And it's really hard to go out there and take risks to make your community a better place, to think you can even do anything in your community if you don't have that strong foundation. So the future leaders of our world need to start off in a strong way as a young child.
So Sheree, as a pastor, whenever we've done orphan-focused mission, our number one desire is on the children. You know, we want the children to do well. We want them to be educated. We want them to grow and be nurtured, etc. And that's not quite enough. As a pastor, I want those lives transformed, and I want our lives in the church transformed. In other words, I think it can do two things, not just one. So what I'm wondering is, have you seen impact in your congregation because of this engagement in orphan-focused missions?
You know, one of my favorite things, and I think I've seen this from other people who have engaged in this type of work, is there is nothing that gives you a greater sense of joy and satisfaction than seeing someone who has dignity, who can look you in the eye, who is confident to make a difference, that doesn't feel downtrodden, set aside. One of the things that I've learned from children that are either on the streets or in orphanages is that the community looks down on them. One, they're a bane on the community, meaning that they require funds, they steal, they, you know, help create additional problems, whether that has to do with health or other challenges, that a lot of the community looks down on them. If they're out on the streets or if they're in an orphanage and they're like, gosh, you know what? You grew up having all these people bring you stuff. You grew up in a warm bed. You grew up with good food. And I grew up not having all those things. And so now you're out and I don't like you because you had a head start, even though they didn't mentally and emotionally, but materially they did. So when you have these children that have this dignity because they were loved, that have these confidence and they feel good about themselves and they are becoming leaders. And then you bring our people in relationship with them. So people may go and just connect, pray, get to know, learn from each other. It's truly transformational. It's not us coming to help someone else. Oh, you poor person. It's us getting to know an equal and getting to know a different culture and just breaking bread together. And that is where transformation takes place. We learn from them. They learn from us. And it's a beautiful sharing of the body of Christ.
So Wayne, as someone who's helped a congregation make a transition from institution-based care to family-based care, a fear that could be very, very present is, oh my goodness, if we lose our connection to this institution, this orphanage, that negatively affects us. And people may not want to do it for that. And so I'm curious, in your opinion, how can that actually help the church? How can that help with the transformation that we're trying to do with people who are in the life of the congregation?
Yeah, so my kids don't go to church. I speak to all my clergy friends, you know, we're all in our 60s. Virtually none of us have children who go to church. They're all turned off by the church. They're turned off by what they see on TV. I think the priest scandal hurt me because if you can't trust a priest, you can't trust a United Methodist pastor, and most people don't even know the difference. So I think that hurt me. I think the TV evangelists hurt us. We see TV pastors living in $10 million houses. I think the schism our denomination is facing hurts us. You know, you're either pro-LGBTQIA or you're not, and you see us fighting over this for 50 years. There's many issues that have hurt us. Churches fighting over political issues, right? There's pro-Trump Christians and there's anti-Trump Christians. This is what can unite us. This is what can bring us together. All the young people I know in my college classes and my kids, they want to go to a church that's making a difference in the world. They don't want to go to a church that's fighting over the color of the carpet. They don't want to go to a church that's fighting over politics or whose pastor is promoting war and violence, or whose pastor is living in a $10 million house. They want to go to church where they can be involved. When I first went to Mozambique in 1998, I didn't feel like I wanted to go, but I felt called. I was actually out running one day, and I heard this sense of go to Mozambique. So when I got home, I called my mentor and I said, Clayton, I heard this voice in my head, go to Mozambique. What should I do? And he said, Wayne, I think you should go to Mozambique. Son of a gun, you know? So I went to Mozambique. But the next 7 years while I served that church, 12 other people from my church went to Mozambique. We disagreed on everything, political and religious, but we agreed to take care of those kids. Our church grew. I won the Harry Denman Evangelism Award because our church grew from 85 people to 350 people a week during that time we were engaged in ministry in Mozambique. So it can help small churches. I think people are afraid to bring me in because they think I'll siphon money off their church for our orphans. But what happens is it unites a church. It energizes them, lets them go tell their neighbors, hey, we're doing something exciting in our church. We're taking care of these children that are dying without our help. So it can help individual churches. It gave me something. It was the most important thing I did in my life in terms of ministry. And it can help our denomination during these dark days that we're all going through.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the young people not going to church. Young people want to do something relevant in this world. And if they find out the church is doing something relevant, they actually might just want to be
come
a part
back.
Of the
they
church.
Might come back.
Yeah.
So friends, those of you who are listening and watching, this campaign is going to launch at the Church of the Resurrection Leadership Institute, which is September 28th through 30th. And by the way, if you haven't signed up for the Church of the Resurrection's Leadership Institute, do that right now. Go online and sign up. It's really one of the best leadership experiences that laity and clergy have available to them in the country. It's really outstanding and very practical. Well, during that, we're going to have a special session called Breaking Bread from House to House. That's going to occur on September the 29th at 4:30 p.m. And I want you to mark your calendar, September the 29th, 4:30 p.m. at the Church of the Resurrection. Nebs, tell us a little bit about that event and why people should attend, whether they currently support children in orphanage settings or not.
Yeah, thank you. Well, as you rightly said, the event is a very special session offered on the date, the 29th at 4:30 and at Church of the Resurrection. Of course, we'll provide sandwiches because we can't break bread without bread, right? So it's not going to be a lecture. As I said, it's going to be a fun, meaningful, engaging conversation. We are in like-minded people, and you don't have to be, as Tom rightly said, you don't have to be supporting an orphanage, or you don't have to be an orphanage operator or something like that. Because you just care for orphans, you just care for vulnerable children, you just want the best for children. So that's going to be there, and just care about the conversation about what the Bible is calling us to do and to care for orphans and how we can do it best. Because, hey, friends, as we talk about problem exists, you know, as we talk about this, we have millions of children are trapped in institutional care. And then we have many more that are on the road to go into those institutions. But there's a way out. We can intervene. We can prevent this from happening. But we cannot do this alone. We cannot do ministry alone. We can't do this in isolation. We need cooperation. We need collaboration. That's why we are doing this together. Come together around the table and talk about engaging meaningful conversation and talk about the best way possible. How can we help? And can we use our strength and skills combined together to do this together?
So, Sheree, I hope everybody comes to the Church of the Resurrection for the Leadership Institute and joins us at that seminar. Yeah. But what about listeners who won't be able to join us? What could they do if they want to know more about how to engage in orphan-based mission in a way that truly helps kids and families?
So yeah, if they can't attend the event, they can reach out to anyone on this panel. I know our contact information will be in the show notes. I know all of us would be happy to answer any questions, share our experiences, encourage in any way, because we think this is really important. We can also, they can continue to listen to Optimistic Voices. I know you guys will continue to have information on your podcast, as well as our Bridging Cultures podcast, a podcast that we are doing at Church of the Resurrection, where we're talking about in season 3, orphan and vulnerable children. Because again, this is a very important topic. And we hope that this is a new wave of looking at how to care for orphan and vulnerable children. So if they can attend Leadership Institute and attend that workshop, it's not even going to be so much a workshop as a listen lecture. It's really going to be a conversation where you sit around a table. And of course, there's going to be sandwiches, because at a breaking bread event, you have to have bread. And then everyone will just be asking each other questions, talking through things, and really dreaming about what it might look like to care for children in a family-based model.
Last question. This is the lightning round for all of you, each of you. What keeps you optimistic or hopeful about your work on this topic? Listen, the number is getting larger, not smaller. It's a complicated issue. Last question. What keeps you optimistic or hopeful about your work related to children who are orphans?
Well, I've always been accused of being an optimistic person. I remember at my staff parish relations evaluation, they'd say, Wayne, you're not a glass half full person. You're a glass overflowing person. And so maybe that'll be on my tombstone. Wayne was too optimistic. But I am optimistic because I think we found the right answer. If you want to be biblical, help us help these children. If you want to be Wesleyan, help us help these children. If you want your church to grow, help us help these children. And what we've found is that this is not just us with our burden, telling them what to do and how to do it. These are African-based models that work. And we're in partnership with these people. The spirituality of my African brothers and sisters puts me to shame sometimes. These are loving, caring, kind people who help me grow in my faith. They know where these kids' families are. They know what they need to move forward. So it's a partnership, not us coming in as, the fancy Americans who are going to solve their problems. I'm optimistic because we found the right answer for us individually and for congregations and for a denomination.
I think I'm optimistic because every time I see a child that feels loved and cared for, that's one more child that is going to have a bright future. I've seen both Zoe children that just stand up tall and just beam with pride of what they've accomplished. I've seen children from Helping Children Worldwide stand in solidarity with their father, who just loves them deeply, and just all of them beaming. Every single child is that has the success just gives me hope for our future, because they're our future. And even if it's just one child, you say, why would you do all this for one child? And one of the stories, which I'm sure all of us have heard at some point, is the story of the man with the starfish on the beach. Thousands of starfish, sunny day, and a man's just throwing one starfish in at a time. And someone comes up and says, why are you throwing the starfish back in the ocean? And the man says, well, I'm trying to save the starfish. And he goes, there's thousands on this beach. There's no way you can save them all. And the man looks at him and he said, I just saved that one. So every child that we bring closer in a family that's cared and loved for, that's one more child. I will always be optimistic as long as we keep reaching one more child.
Yeah, very, very optimistic about that transformation is happening. And then this is a journey, and people are coming on board, and people know that they are on the different stages along this journey. And people who are involved in this ministry, who have hearts for children and for orphans, for vulnerable families, they are listening in, and it's slow, but changes are happening. So I'm very more optimistic about the future of children, that as people are coming together to find a better way. And I'm also very hopeful, because people know home is not just where we live. Home is where we belong. And that home is family. And everybody, they want to give children who live in institutions, children who live on the street, a home and a family.
That's great. Well, friends, thank you for joining us today for this episode of Optimistic Voices. There is no shortage of need. And here at Optimistic Voices, we believe that with real courage, with radical courage, radical collaboration together, we can actually change the world. Thank you for giving your time to this. And to those of you who joined us today on the panel, thank you very, very much for your time as well.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from us, you can find us at Helping Children Worldwide on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Hashtag Optimistic Voices Podcast.
We hope you'll continue listening and get involved in the mission to strengthen and empower families and communities. Together, we can change the world. To learn how you can get involved, go to helpingchildrenworldwide.org.